Yeah, thanks, Peter. Can everyone hear me at the back okay? Good, excellent. Okay, so look, yeah, the long boom was an unprecedented phenomenon in world capitalism. The Western economies, and in fact the Eastern economy, the world economy as a whole, actually boomed for the best part of 25 or 30 years. There had never been such a period of sustained growth in the world capitalist system since capitalism emerged as a dominant social system in the 18th and 19th centuries. We saw, obviously, the victorious powers in World War II, the United States and the Soviet Union, grow fairly systematically and substantially. The United States was occupied about 50% of world manufacturing at the stage, overwhelmingly the dominant power. We see, even though the defeated countries, Germany and Japan, actually prosper in the 1950s and 60s, growing very rapidly. Britain and France, with their big empires, gradually begin to decolonize and grow somewhat more slowly, but still nonetheless fairly rapid growth there as well. This is a period not just of kind of notching up, you know, growth in GDP and investment and so forth. It's also a period of rising living standards for the majority of the population. For the working class, this period between 1945 and the early 1970s was again like the longest sustained period of full employment for most working class families, which is very unusual in the history of capitalism. In that sense, actually the full employment, the fact that everyone could find work, was actually the main thing that actually pushed up working class living standards in this period. There was plenty of overtime. The bosses, because there was full employment, were happy to, for a period of time, to offer higher wages. And for many working class families in countries like Australia, this is their first opportunity to buy a home and maybe even take a short holiday, that sort of thing. So the main thing about the post-war boom, though, is how unexpected it was. No one predicted it. Not the bourgeois economists and not the socialist economists. They basically looked at the history of capitalism before the war and saw the fact that Western capitalism had gone into a deep crisis, the Great Depression. Unemployment had gone up to 20 or 30%. Output and investment had collapsed. World trade had collapsed. And looking at the situation after World War One, when soldiers were demobilized and the wartime industries were wound back, we saw those economies fall into a slump in late 1990, 1920. So every expectation then, based on what happened after the First World War and what happened in the 1930s, was that once World War II ended, as the soldiers came back home, as women left their factories, the soldiers taking their place, where there would then be a resumed depression. No one anticipated the fact that for 25 or 30 years after the war, the world economy would boom like never before. This was a major turn in world capitalism, and it was to have tremendous political effects, which we'll talk about as we go along.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, now that you've set the scene about the long boom, why don't you talk us through the economic factors of what caused this unprecedented expansion in the capitalist economy?
Yeah, sure. Well, if, like me, you studied economics in the 1970s, maybe not many people in this room did that, a high school and university, you'll have been told something that was actually, it's all this clever guy called John Maynard Keynes, who was a Cambridge economist in the 1930s, who wrote a book called The General Theory of Interest, Employment and Money, which basically argued that the private capitalist economy was never going to generate full employment because there was always a tendency to underinvest. So what Keynes said was the government had to step in with spending packages to boost the capitalist economy and pick it up out of the doldrums and create full employment. So Keynes argued then there was a role for active, what he called demand management, to tweak fiscal policy, that is government spending taxation, to lift the private capitalist sector out of depression and generate long-term growth. Now that's what we were all taught. But clever people have gone back on this, actually, and studied the history and found out actually very few Western governments actually practice Keynesian demand management at all. So the world economy managed to prosper and grow in the 1950s and 60s without anything really particularly Keynesian about it. In fact, actually, the Keynesian policies tended to come about in the late 60s and early 70s, precisely, in fact, to respond to the crisis in the system at that point. So it was not Keynesian demand management. You see, the thing about Keynesian demand management is that the problem was essentially underconsumption. The working class living standards were too low. Actually, what Marxists look at is investment. Investment really is the engine of growth. And what investment depends upon is the capitalist's ability to get a decent rate of return on their money. That is, they don't just want to spend money on new equipment and make nothing out of it. So what we have to look at ultimately then is, for Marxists, anyone really wants to understand how the economies work, is what's going on with the rate of profit. Now, that requires a small diversion. I hope you'll bear with me here, which is that if you've been around Marxists for any length of time, you might have heard something called the long-term tendency of the rate of profit to fall, which is a hell of a mouthful. It basically means that that engine of capitalist growth, the rate of profit, tends to subside over time. I'll have to skate over the explanation why. Simply that capitalist competition demands that every capitalist invest more and more money in equipment and automation, mechanization, bumping up the amount of machinery in the hands of the average worker. Now, that phenomenon, very crudely, is what Marx referred to as another mouthful, the organic composition of capital. If you want to, a simplified version might be the ratio of capital to labor. That is the amount of machinery, equipment, raw materials the average worker has at their disposal to turn your raw materials into finished products. So over time, you only have to think about back in the early Industrial Revolution, people were using hand tools. By the 1950s and 60s, they're using huge, you know, mechanical instruments, you know, presses and whatever in factories. The average worker then has at their disposal so much more capital equipment. The problem for the capitalists, though, is that even though they're driven to do this, to cheapen their cost of production to compete with their other rival capitalists, the thing that actually produces new value for the system is not the machinery. It's actually the workers. Marx referred tellingly to the workers as living labor, which is a kind of expenditure that actually creates more value than it itself costs. To use the terminology, creates more value than the value of labor power. What it means is that if a worker works for 8 hours, generally speaking, in the first 4 hours, they'll make enough products or whatever to basically pay for their wage. And the remaining 4 hours in an 8-hour day, essentially expropriated by the capitalists in the form of surplus labor, which they then convert to profits by selling goods. So it kind of means that capitalism survives on the basis of exploiting workers, a phrase you'll probably hear lots in this conference. Okay, but so that means, therefore, that it's only the workers are capable of producing value. The more you outlay money on machinery relative to the amount you outlay on workers, the more you have to dilute the rate of profit. Because imagine you're now spending twice as much machinery for the same amount of worker. The worker is still producing a certain amount of value, but you've now, if you like, the denominator in the equation is so much higher. Because you have to divide the total outlay now, which is one worker plus twice as much capital. But the top thing, the numerator, is always the same. It's a certain amount of surplus being produced by the worker. So I'm sorry if that bamboozled a lot of you. Simply means there's a tendency for rate of profit to fall, which is not something due to mismanagement or anything. It's to do with the very workings of capitalism that drives a capitalist for fear of failure to keep investing more into things that actually don't produce new value. So that becomes the major problem. That undermines the system. So just bear with me. I'm sorry. I have to take it a bit longer than I intended. We then have to look at what actually happens to the rate of profit after World War II, because you would think if this kind of declining rate of profit thing happened to carry through, that the economies would be falling into a slump, much like the economists predicted by 1950 or 55. That didn't happen. So we have to ask why it was that the rate of profit didn't fall steadily after World War II, or maybe didn't fall as fast as it might have done otherwise. There's two explanations for this. I'll deal with one of them and we'll come back to Priya. The first explanation is because during World War II and the Great Depression, a period really from 1930 to 1945, the capital stock, the total amount of capital in the hands of the capitalist classes of Japan and Germany, most obviously, because it's destroyed by bombing. But even in the United States and Britain also bombed, there's actually a depletion of capital going on as a result of the massive depreciation of capital during the Great Depression, the shutdowns, the selling off, the bankruptcies and so forth. And even during World War II, partly because just because of destruction and partly because lack of investment in the civilian industry, the actual capital stock sinks. And what that does then is actually reduce the amount of capital in the hands of the average worker to reduce the organic composition of capital. And therefore that tends to boost the rate of profit. So essentially what we saw by 1945 was the world economy was no longer set to slump because the previous 15 years had actually created a new opportunity to spring forward by kind of contradictions of capitalism by destroying capital. Actually, the fact that they destroyed so much capital created the basis for a new round of growth, which sounds absurd, but that's one of the absurdities of the way capitalism works.
Okay, cool. All right. Bit of an economic roller coaster there, Tom. We'll work through these concepts in the discussion. All right. Let's introduce politics into the mix now. So, you know, something, I never made it through. I couldn't stomach learning economics, actually, from bourgeois universities, partly because one of the things that they do, which really shits me off, is they segment every social process into neat little boxes. So politics on one hand here, economics on another, and then kind of social processes can even be in a different box to that. Marxists see the world very differently. We see that economics and politics are unified, are combined in a kind of contradictory totality. And I think it'd be good, Tom, talk us through, in particular in this period, what was going on in the realm of imperialism. So kind of, competition between states was very kind of transformative and had a big economic impact. So, it might be good to talk through what impact imperialism had on the world's economy, and in particular, a theory that some people will be familiar with of like the permanent arms economy.
Sure,
catch your breath and talk to that.
Okay. So look, if we're talking 1945, obviously the salient feature, above anything else, was the emergence, well, what became 2 years later, the emergence of the Cold War. The United States and the Soviet Union emerged as the victors in the war. Initially, there was a certain kind of uneasy peace between them, but by 1948, the rivalry had been declared full bore. So what essentially happened at this point is the United States rallied its allies, the Soviet Union rallied, well, its allies, its kind of conquered territory in Eastern Europe, to form two rival blocs. They were later to be the European Community, NATO, and on the Eastern side, it was going to be Comecon and the Warsaw Pact. Essentially, what you had was two blocks of capital facing off against each other for competition essentially over the entire Eurasian landmass, all the way from China to Ireland. So that was what the Cold War was, essentially, the kind of jockeying between these two major blocks of capital and military expenditure. Now, the thing was, they competed, but they didn't compete through maybe a normal way. The Soviet bloc was much weaker than America. Had it been up to pure economic competition between US companies and Russian companies would have been destroyed by American market competition. So the imperialist competition between the two blocs actually took the form primarily of military competition, because economic competition was quarantined by the Eastern Bloc by virtue of the Soviet Union essentially putting up a wall, metaphorical to begin with, but actual, literal, in the case of Berlin, a wall between East and West, which meant they didn't compete primarily economically. Most of the economic transactions happened within their own bloc. The competition took the form of military competition. And so what you saw after 1945, you saw the Korean War, but of course you have a new surge in military spending. But then after that, civilian peacetime military spending doesn't sink back to the rate it was before, much higher than it was in the interwar period, 5, 6, 7 times as higher. This does a couple of things. First of all, obviously, if you're an arms company, you love this, because you're going to make lots of money out of long-term government projects for submarines, for cannons, for tanks, for aircraft, whatever it might be. So if you are in the military section of big capital, you love this stuff. It feeds your order books. It gives you long-term contracts. It gives you a bit of stability, gives you some opportunity to invest. And so you can see how a portion of American capitalism really American and Russian capitalism, I should say, kind of benefited from this process. Now, in case of the Soviet Union, because their economy was so much smaller and because they were competing with the Americans militarily, they had to devote even more money, in fact, into their military, relatively speaking, because they had to match the US kind of tank for tank, gun for gun. Now, the problem with this is an explanation, and I think it's certainly a factor, obviously helps to explain booms in certain sectors of the US economy, for example, or can explain perhaps a boom at particular times. But it can't explain the whole post-war boom. The simple fact that the money that the Pentagon uses to order all its military equipment has to come from somewhere, unless the government just runs up huge gargantuan budget deficits, which actually does begin to happen, but not until the 1970s. The significance here that, so what happens is that money has to come from taxes. So essentially you can say, well, okay, the Pentagon military spending boosts the sections of some capitals, but it also must deplete spending in other capitals, consumer goods perhaps, because of taxation of consumer good companies and taxation of working class living standards to pay for the arms budget. So in some ways, it's a case of some sectors paying Peter to, whatever the expression is, robbing Peter to pay Paul. So we actually have to look at another dimension of arms spending rather than just those kind of stimulatory effects. It's one of another absurdity of capitalism, that these governments, Americans and Russians, spent an inordinate amount of money on the military, but which from a purely economic point of view was waste production or waste consumption, I said. Some calls it unproductive consumption. You think about companies spending money on cars. You know, that is, they produce cars, consumers buy them. You can see the consumer spending feeding back into the company revenue books. They then use that money to invest more in car production. Arms production is not like that. Arms production simply leads to the production of weapons that lie in silos, completely wasted or blown up, completely wasted. So the phenomenon of military spending is a particular form of economic activity that what it actually does is to drain investment capital out of sectors where it could be used productively, like, for example, in producing cars or producing milk or computers, and actually diverts it into production as actually waste production. That is, it does not feed back into new rounds of accumulation. So what you're doing here, that's why you need to remember that thing about capital and organic compositions and so forth, is you are holding back a portion of investment that would otherwise go into expanding, let's say, civilian industries or expanding working class living standards. Instead, what you're doing is essentially getting a spade and digging a hole in the ground and burying the money there. So what that does is to detract from the accumulation of capital in productive uses. So what that does is then begin to put downward pressure in a rate of capital accumulation. It may not cut it entirely. I'm not saying it reverses it, but it means if, let's say, for every $100 you've got of investable capital, if you put that all into, let's say, car manufacture, your kind of productivity in car manufacturing will spring forwards, your capital stock in car manufacturing will spring forwards, and you'll also help to actually depress the rate of profit because you're increasing organic composition of capital. You put $30 out of that 100, or in the case of the United States, $50 out of that 100 into military spending, actually only releases $50 for car manufacturing, which therefore there has less of an additive effect on capital accumulation. That's another kind of long-winded way of saying then is that arms production, what it does is actually it flattens the economic process. It means that the economic booms that happen are not as sharp as they were before the war, but nor the economic recessions as deep as they were. What it tends to do is to stretch out a period of economic growth over a longer period, even to have growth at a lower rate. But because it's sustained over 25 years on a cumulative basis, you get a much bigger outcome at the end of that process than you've had the economy going like that. So you've got it kind of going like that. And therefore the general accumulation, you know, the growth of GDP is so much more peripheral, is so much more substantial. So that's actually how the permanent arms economy works. There's a diversion of investment funds into military infrastructure and industry, which slows down the dynamism of the private capitalist sector. And it slows it down, but also prevents it from falling into slumps as a result of the falling rate of profit.
So we've gone through what the long boom was, an unprecedented expansion in the world's capitalist economy. And you talked us through what economic factors drove the long boom, how that related to world imperialism. I think it'd be good now to talk about the political ramifications of the long boom. So, you know, this, like, without preempting it too much, the political organizations and ideology for people on the left, even in the Marxist tradition and for right-wing defenders of capitalism, you know, the period of the long boom actually caused a lot of turmoil and rethinking and new ideas and confusions, I would argue. Let's stay in the realm of politics, but let's move to, what impact did the long boom have on the left? On politics.
Yeah, sure. I think the major factor was that because it seemed to run so counter to the expectations, it actually was a bit of it kind of bamboozled people in the sense that the capitalists and the socialists were both expecting the world economy to go into depression. And the depression was a great learning experience for the ruling class and also for the working class in actually telling us that the capitalist system was fundamentally flawed. Now, the capitalists, of course, kind of their reaction to that is to go to war and have fascism. But for the left, it actually was, if you like, it was an argument that seemed to confirm Marxist arguments that capitalism is this fundamentally flawed system. The post-war boom had the opposite effect. It actually seemed to reassure the ruling class that here you have 30 years of sustained growth, capitalism maybe isn't a system of crisis. And so this is a period, if you like, of ruling class confidence in the system. It seemed to be the system worked. There weren't any deep crises. There weren't any economic collapses to speak of. And they basically, as a result of a whole series of factors, came up with something that was called a mixed economy. That is, it was a private sector economy, which was leavened with a certain degree of state intervention, maybe nationalized industries, maybe a degree of state direction of investment. It was a commitment to full employment. There was fairly steady growth year after year, a welfare state, fairly kind of partial in a lot of countries, but still some spending on health services, schooling, and so forth. And so you had a period then where political stability was more or less the norm. Governments kind of repeatedly re-elected, like 30 years of one-party government, essentially in countries like Germany, Italy, Japan, and elsewhere. And in the United States, you simply alternate between Republicans and Democrats, the same party just spelled differently. But it's also true it gave confidence to the Russian ruling class. So confident were they. In fact, their economy grew faster that Khrushchev, the Russian leader, in 1960, told diplomats from the West, he said, we will bury you. He didn't mean they're going to send Earth over or anything. He meant that the inexorable rise of the state-planned economy was going to prove its superiority to the market economy, and the Soviet Union would just simply destroy the West economically. Eventually, you know, Russia would release its markets, and it would just wipe out Western industry. That's what they thought. That's what, in fact, and it wasn't just the Eastern economists thought this. Some Western economists thought this too, because the Russian economy and others were growing by 7 or 10% a year. So again, ruling class confidence, both West and East. For the working class, it also had impact because for a long period, you saw rising living standards. You saw full employment. You saw overtime. You saw workers begin to have consumer goods they'd never had before, beyond the dreams of their parents. But it's also had an impact in depoliticizing the working class. If you think about the Depression, think about the previous period, you've got two world wars, you've got the rise of fascism, you've got the Russian Revolution, you've got Stalinism. Political questions cannot be avoided. You've got the whole world systems up in flames. And therefore, and also because unemployment was quite high for a long period of time, tremendous faith that governments or parties could do things in office. So the state was a question of contestation because you couldn't win a wage rise because there was 30% unemployment. So what you had to do was look to the state to bring about reforms. So there was a degree of that. Or in fact, you know, you looked to politics to overthrow the existing state. What you saw in the post-war boom was it seemed like the system could deliver. And therefore tended to lead to a certain retreat politically. Not to say that workers all loved the Menzies government or anything, or loved the Tories in Britain, or particularly loved, you know, Eisenhower in America. But it was a case that less political engagement by the working class going on. And that was also the case because the USSR seemed to be less attractive. For a long period of time, of course, they benefited from the illusions and, well, the reality of the Russian Revolution. But by the 1950s and 60s, the fact that the Soviet Union was not all that great was becoming obvious to more people. And the final factor was because there was full employment, workers could win wage rises and lift their living standards just by going on strike. Or in fact, because the bosses offered you wage rises anyway, they're so desperate to get labor. And so you saw working class living standards rise and a degree of political disengagement. The other thing that happens is this creates turmoil and trauma on the left. So you have a bunch of people who were in and around the Labour parties, the Social Democratic parties and the Great Depression who said, right, that's it. We thought you could fix the system. It turns out you can't. We have to have a total social transformation. They still kind of saw themselves maybe as like left social democrats, maybe even independent Marxists or whatever. But they thought that, okay, the system has clearly failed. We need to change things. 20 years later, these people are now saying, whoa, I was wrong. The system can deliver. And so they begin to develop little projects about how we can have a bit more welfare state, a bit more public spending on education or whatever, but to give up their ideas of social transformation. Outside social democracy, you also see, difficulties in dealing with the situation. Obviously, because they had expected there to be a new depression. The Stalinists, the communist parties, they basically told them whatever Russia told them. And Russia told them, and this is their politics at the time, the West is about to collapse. There's going to be a world crisis that's going to wipe out the Western economies and socialism will emerge triumphant. And they basically told the communist parties to follow that line. But obviously by the 1950s, it became clear that was not the case. Nonetheless, Moscow still started promoting that line, along with the idea you should cooperate and collaborate with your own ruling class. So it was a bit kind of contradictory what they were saying. What about the Trotskyists? Because the Trotskyists didn't obviously obey whatever Russia told them, but nonetheless, they unfortunately stuck with what Trotsky told them in 1938. And in 1938, Trotsky said that this is the death agony of capitalism. That capitalism is irredeemably doomed, that the coming world war will see the total collapse of Western economies, will see the collapse of Stalinism. And therefore, the Trotskyists in the late 1940s were busy telling each other, yeah, it may look like this will apply, but it may look like there's a boom, but really, hey, you know, it's all going to end tomorrow. And so you have a situation where the forces on the left in the late 40s and into the 50s are completely at odds with the reality of what's happening. The reality of what's happening is they're being set in train, a sustained long-term boom, and yet the left is essentially, with some exceptions, saying that no, it's all going to end any time now, just you wait. So of course, you know, they're like, whatever, like, I'm not sure what it is, Cassandra, one of them, it's all predicting doom, and the doom never arrives, so they begin to look a bit more silly as the years go by.
Well, so we've talked about the system as a whole, then we've zoomed in on political ramifications. I reckon let's go back and think about the zoom out once more and think about, if you could talk us through what, changes took place in world capitalism during the long boom that kind of had long lasting ramifications for the system. This is rather a turning point in the history of the system.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, there's a few factors here. One is, as I explained before, the US was dominant power. Germany and Japan were weaklings, recovering from being blitzed to smithereens by Allied bombing. So Germany and Japan are actually told by the American occupation forces they are not to rebuild their militaries. So what the emerging, the reviving capitalist classes of these two countries do is spend a lot of money on civilian manufacturing re-equipment. So they go into production, with all new machinery, with the latest machinery, much less of it than the United States has. But if you like, they can start, it's sacrilege to kind of say Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but it allows them to start, with a clean slate. Everything's been bombed flat. And so essentially, they're not going to start up with machinery. They're not going to invest in machinery that's 100 years old or 50 years old or 30 years old like the Americans are using. They're going to start up with the latest machinery. So they begin to expand their economies, and they do that on the back of American military spending. American military spending, by virtue, by keeping the rate of profits reasonably comfortable, actually helps to float the whole world economy. And Japan and Germany are able to build up their own industries and export to American markets on the strength of that. So Japan and Germany become a bigger and more important economic force. And as they do so, starting with transistor radios, toys, bed linen or whatever it might be, gradually to move up, as we now say, the value chain, and move along to things like motorbikes and bicycles and stereo units, and then begin to move up into cars. And so the American companies initially said, "Jap crap, load of rubbish, you'll never sell in America," suddenly find their roads are full of Toyotas and Volkswagens, blitzing the Dodges and the Chryslers and whatever. So that begins to hurt the Americans. The second thing that happens is that the long boom creates tremendous labor shortages for the capitalist classes. They've got to find new workers. They've got to find new, labor to exploit. So they start looking for areas like, for example, housewives. And that's what, women working at home were called at the time. So they dragged them out of the home. I remember I was born in 1960. I remember seeing advertisements of all these advertisements in women's magazines. Come and work at Hoover. Come and work at, whatever it might have been, Dulux or some consumer goods industries, light industry. We will pay you well. We'll organize a bus to take you to the factory. They were desperate to get women into the workforce. They were desperate for immigration. Look at Australia, most obviously, but at Britain, from the West Indies, from the subcontinent, from Germany, from Turkey, Lebanon, from the United States, from the blacks in the deep south, from Latin Central America. So big influx of migrant workers. There's also a big influx of rural workers dragged out of the villages as the country urbanizes. Southern Italy, wholesale, move north up into Milan and Turin, Florence and so forth into industry, away from their kind of small farms. Another factor that happens is students. Students. The capitalist industry is becoming more technologically sophisticated. The capitalist state machine is getting bigger and bigger, needing more skilled labor to supervise it and staff it. And so you see the capitalists begin to open up universities all over the place, to open the doors of the universities to expand the tertiary workforce. And so in all these situations, you see, if you like, a reconstruction of the civilian life. You see a big influx of historically oppressed and downtrodden groups of workers moving into factories, being treated initially like shit, but then begin to say, after a few years, most obviously in the case of blacks in America, we're not going to put up with this anymore. The case of migrants in Australia, the Four Broadmeadows factory in Melbourne, we're not going to put up with this anymore. And the case of the students faced with being pushed into extremely cramped residential colleges with lecture theatres which are bursting at the seams, with university professors who've been there for 90 years and still teaching the same lectures and disrespecting the students, and university rectors who basically regard universities as being, you know, puritanical sort of, you know, monasteries and nunneries. None has really sat well with the students. And none of the education they were being delivered, which was, you know, pro-capitalist, pro-establishment, they weren't going to have this anymore. So you begin to see the seeds of revolt, which even begin emerging by the mid-60s amongst all these layers of the population. In Eastern Europe, you see a similar phenomena. Well, workers coming out of the villages, the peasants coming out of the villages, going to work in the industrial districts. And the situation there, where the economic and the political demands come together very readily, because in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, the boss is also the government, because the way in which the Communist Party state industry runs everything. And so workers who start out with economic demands for better treatment of work very quickly come up against the fact, well, it's the party running this factory. And so start raising political demands for freedom to organize independent trade unions, freedom of the press, freedom to assemble. So straight away, you see in countries like Poland, a sequence of revolts, if you like, by the working class, which are focused on both economic and political demands. The final thing I'll talk about in terms of the post-war boom is the war in Vietnam. The war in Vietnam is kind of now regarded as, oh, that's a terrible mistake. Why on earth did the United States do this? Why on earth did they commit so much to Vietnam? There was actually a rational explanation for Vietnam, even though it sounds crazy today. The rational expectation was, in a world dominated by two camps, the United States and the Eastern Bloc, basically what was mine and what was yours is yours. And if you try taking what was mine, I'm going to fight you for it. And so in a decolonizing world, in Indochina, in Africa, a range of other places, the issue about who is going to control slabs of the world became quite important. With France pulling out or being driven out of Indochina, the question then was, who's going to control this region? Was it going to be the United States or was it going to be Russia? And so essentially, the United States has to commit to its proxy, the South Vietnamese government, in order to try and push Russia and China back. That's essentially the thing. Its U.S. credibility was at stake. If the U.S.-backed government was seen to fall, that would make the United States look weak in a world of rival imperialisms. The Vietnam War, of course, was a disaster. It was a disaster militarily. The United States was driven out, essentially. It was a disaster economically in terms of the cost of running the war. It was a disaster politically in the sense it radicalized whole generations of university students and African Americans and also GIs in the military. And as a result of which, the American ruling class by the early 1970s have been politically discredited, both domestically and to some degree internationally as well, as overseeing this disaster that was the Vietnam War.
Cool. All right. Well, I reckon before we move into the all-in discussion, just why don't you draw some political conclusions for us from this period? So people thought the long boom would last forever and usher in a period of untrammeled capitalist growth and stability. It did not do that. It ended eventually. You know, maybe you can just, without going into exactly why it ended, just introduced how it started to go down. And then maybe you could draw some conclusions about what that says about the system of capitalism in general. You could draw some of the theoretical generalizations from it.
Sure. Okay, well, look, I said 25 years of long-term growth. By 1970, the Western economies hit the first coordinated recession, really since the 1930s. So that was a sign things were beginning to go awry. Why? Well, the rate of profit had tended to started to fall quite seriously. Now, their initial response was basically to try and spend a lot more government money to try and pick the economy back up again. This, unfortunately for them, only stoked inflation. And as the capitalists started to wind back their investments to protect their profit margins, that tended to create higher unemployment as well. So you had this new phenomenon that actually the economists have told people that could never happen, the phenomenon of stagflation, that is simultaneous unemployment and inflation, which completely threw the entire economics profession, because they've been teaching students like me for 25 years that actually such a thing could not occur. You either had unemployment and you had no inflation, or you had inflation and no unemployment. All of a sudden, you had both rising inflation and rising unemployment. So they were thrown by that. So to understand why the rate of profit begins to fall, and why therefore governments are trying to find some solution to this by pumping up spending. One argument is that what happened was the working class squeezed the capitalists by going on strike for higher wages. The problem with that, therefore, the share of profits and national income fell. The problem with that explanation is that when you take into account things like taxation, the favorable treatment of capital rather than workers, actually the share of capital didn't fall that much. And also the rate of profit was falling in countries like Germany and Japan, where there was basically no working class militancy at this stage. So the profit share was falling and the rate of profit was falling, the rate of profit was falling, but it didn't seem to have any necessary correlation with the strike rate. Okay, you might be able to argue that for Britain, high strike rate of profit falling. But that couldn't apply in Germany and Japan. The rate of profit was falling and there were no strikes. So that couldn't really be the explanation. We have to come back to our friend, the organic composition of capital. Sorry about this. Okay. What was happening? I mentioned Germany and Japan before. What happens is that Germany and Japan start as puny economic forces. Whatever they invest doesn't really matter that much. It's what the United States does is what matters. But by 1970, 75, what Germany and Japan do does matter. They have now become the second and third largest economic forces, at least in the Western world. So their investment decisions do matter. They matter to the global rate of profit, because it's not just the case that the United States stands triumphant and whatever it does is what matters and Germany and Japan down there. You've now got the United States here, Germany there, and Japan there, or maybe Japan there, Germany there. And so once Germany and Japan start spending lots of money on civilian investment in manufacturing, in civilian industries, they do start to begin to have an impact on that organic composition of capital. That is the average amount of capital in the hands of the worker all over the Western economies. So what that does is start to put down pressure on the rate of profit. Because you know, the organic composition of capital, which had risen only fairly slowly by virtue of the permanent arms economy, now starts to rise faster because the Germans and Japanese companies are pushing their investments into the equation. What also happens, I mentioned before, those Volkswagens and Toyota cars on the roads of Britain and America, helping to undermine the British and American car industries, are a bit of a signal to the fact those capitalists need to start thinking about re-equipping themselves. And started in the American case, started thinking about moving out of producing giant cars, you know, the length of this, you know, with all the fins and all the kind of chrome, and start producing cars like little Toyotas that were kind of cheap and reliable and lasted forever. So you begin to see more investment, peacetime investment there. You also see Germany and Japan eating into American export markets and eating into the domestic market in the United States itself. And also you see the whole cost of the Vietnam War bearing down on the U.S. economy. The U.S. can spend vast amounts of money on its military if it's got no economic competition. But once economic competition starts nipping at its heels, then military spending starts to become a bit of an overhead for them. They have to think about this. Well, if we can't keep spending, you know, 9% of our GDP or 7% of our GDP on weapons, if the fact that Japan and Germany are eating our lunch, because they're basically wiping out our producers. So what they do in response to stagflation, well, first of all, they scratch their heads and think, what the fuck's going on? Then they start thinking about how, well, what we need to do is to flood the economy with money. Then that leads to that kind of inflation problem I was saying about. Then they think about what we need to do is just rule by decree and to have wage and price controls. So we will tell companies they cannot put up their prices and we will tell workers they can't have pay rises. The thing is, the ruling class aren't going to put up with having price controls and the working class weren't willing to put up with wage controls. And so that didn't last for very long. So they were then, by 1975, the US is in deep trouble. Its economy is doing badly. The cost of Vietnam is way down in its budget. Political crisis at home with Watergate and the resignation of President Nixon, which is a reflection of the general kind of crisis in the American ruling class at that stage. They couldn't just brush it under the carpet because everything about American politics was being questioned. They also have, you know, the effects of the working class struggle and the black struggles and so forth in the early years. And you also have government intervention in the economy clearly not seem to be working. So you have, a bit of a crisis of political confidence in the Western ruling classes in the mid-1970s. They get out of this by essentially incrementally, step by step, not necessarily as a conscious process, inching to what we now call neoliberalism, what was called economic rationalism and monetarism at different times, just trying to essentially say, well, look, we thought back in the 1960s that government intervention could manage the economy and keep things afloat. We've now, they said, well, we now can conceive then that actually it's government intervention that's the problem. So they kind of say what we need to do is essentially start moving back towards the idea of what's called laissez-faire economics, market economics, Thatcherism or whatever. That is, we're going to start winding back spending on the welfare state. We're going to start cutting corporate taxes. We're going to start setting off some sectors of state industry. Essentially, what we're trying to do is shovel money into the hands of the capitalist class and take it from the working class. Now, they can't go back to the 1930s. The social welfare system is well established, which has a political impact in mediating class struggle, but it also has an impact because the capitalists themselves want educated, healthy, literate workers. So they can't just simply say, right, we're going to close all the schools down. We're going to close all universities down. We're going to close all hospitals down. Because capitalism needs a workforce that can actually turn up at work and follow instructions and run a machinery and computers and whatever. But nonetheless, you start seeing a tightening of the welfare state, greater regulation on who can access it, a whole issue about, you know, mutual obligation, all kind of crap starts coming in. So you start seeing a significant attack on the working class, beginning to push back against the gains of workers have won in the 50s and 60s. You also see deregulation or a re-regulation of capital, a restructuring of capital. So, for example, countries like Australia, whose manufacturing industry have prospered behind tariff wars, the tariff wars are stopped going, and the capitalists here are told, you know, compete internationally or go bust. And so you start seeing a restructuring, and like a look at Britain, wipeout of large-scale manufacturing, and Australia to a lesser degree as well, because there's less manufacturing here in Australia in the first place. But whole areas of Germany and France and Britain and so forth, heavy industry is essentially wiped out by this process. So essentially, it's a process of burning out the less efficient capitalists to try and open up opportunities for the more efficient. I should just say one word before Priya comes back to me, which is that this process, I mentioned Thatcherism, actually wasn't started necessarily by conservatives. It was actually started in Australia with the Hawke and Keating government, in Britain with the Callaghan Labor government in the late 70s, in America with the Democratic administration of Jimmy Carter in 78. So actually, the Social Democrats often take the first steps in this way because, after all, they're loyal to managing a capitalist system.